Refuse Fascism is calling on people to come to D.C. and gather at 11 a.m. at the east side of the U.S. Capitol, bringing signs with their reasons why the whole Trump-Pence regime must go, and to demand witnesses, evidence, a real trial, conviction, and removal. Quote, if Trump is acquitted in a sham trial, a fascist regime will barrel ahead with disastrous consequences for humanity, states Carl Dix of Refuse Fascism. But this is not a done deal. Every day there is more evidence that Trump is guilty and evidence that the whole regime was involved in this crime. People flooding into D.C. can play an important role in breaking this open and forcing the evidence into Trump's trial and build the kind of sustained, nonviolent mass movement that can lead to the removal of the whole Trump-Pence regime. Stop being a spectator. Show up now when it counts. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. These are hellified times today, times that demand our full attention and dedication to standing up against the atrocities being brought down or about to be brought down on the people of the world. These are times when everyone has to be wide awake and ready to stand up against the horrors brought down on the world by U.S. imperialism. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Carl Dix, a revolutionary communist and a follower of Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and someone whose work has carved out path-breaking advances in fighting to make revolution in the U.S. as soon as possible. Dix is also one of the co-founders of Refuse Fascism. And opening the show up, I am very pleased to be talking with Aziz Huq, the Frank and Bernice J. Greenberg Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, as well as the author of How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. We're going to be talking with Aziz about the very dangerous time facing Iranian people in the U.S., including U.S. citizens of Iranian descent. All right, Aziz Huq, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Sure. Well, I have to say, I looked forward to talking with you again, but I also realize when we talk, we're generally talking about things that make your teeth shudder. It's like more than 60 Iranian Americans right now returning to the U.S. recently were detained and questioned for 10 hours at the border. When they tried to return to the U.S. from Canada, this is just one example of what happened to people considered dangerous because they're Iranian Americans. Let's talk about this. This is a dangerous development in itself. Let's talk about where this comes from and why it's so dangerous.
Sure. So this is an administration that has aggressively used the issue of immigration to present itself as being a unqualified defender of national security. And it's largely done this by painting populations who pose no real security threat as being dangerous, right? We've seen this with respect to the southern border. We've seen this with respect to the travel ban. And we got an inkling in the wake of the Soleimani bombing of how this might play out with respect to Iranian Americans. And here we're talking about people who are citizens, as well as people who are, for example, green card holders, being detained and questioned at the border. And this is possible because the border is a location at which many legal rules, like the First Amendment, which prohibits action on the basis of religion or action on the basis of perceived opinion, many of these constitutional protections are relaxed at the border.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that actually really gets me, too, though, is that when you're talking about that, it's not just the fact that there's these things that are relaxed at the border, but there's actually, and you point this out, that this incident enough, that the thing that we were just referencing when I introed it, is that that's bad enough, but it also shows the potential for things to get much worse in relation to Iranian Americans in particular and other Iranians in the U.S. You point out that the legal foundation for punitive actions against Iranian people, Iranian Americans in particular, already exists. What are we talking about here? Because this is a very dangerous, when you think about that, when you think about that, just that statement, it's something that I think people don't necessarily, they don't even understand. Where did that come from? But it's also, you know, there's sort of a way things are layered out so that nobody can question that. Well, Iranians, of course, you know, what are we talking about here? So,
right. We in the United States have a very well-developed stock of statutes and regulations that allow the federal government to exercise quite extraordinary powers over money, which gives them power to freeze people's assets, over liberty, which allows people to be detained without a criminal trial, and punishment, indeed allowing citizens to be detained on the basis of speech and association, despite the First Amendment. This repertoire of statutes and regulations is one that has been built up over time. Each time there is a national crisis that sounds in security terms, whether it be the Oklahoma City bombing, 9/11, the attack on the Pulse nightclub or the like, there is a reaction in the form of new statutes and new regulations that add to the federal government's powers. And Congress rarely goes back and repeals any of these. And the federal courts have really never stood in the way of their implementation. So how we got there is adding piece by piece new powers every time a security panic hits.
You know, one of the things that you've mentioned in this piece that you wrote, you point out that the kind of repression we're talking about does go back to the time of George W. Bush, when he created the category of specially designated global terrorists. That's a pretty heavy statement, and I want you to talk about that. What is it, and what's the impact of it today? What was the impact then, and what's the impact today?
Yeah, so lots of people know that we have a regime of financial sanctions that allow the government to freeze people's assets when they're a hostile foreign state or a hostile group overseas like Hezbollah or Hamas. What people don't realize is that since 2001, as a matter of presidential directive, not as a matter of statute, but as a matter of unilateral executive action, there has been created a category of specially designated global terrorists, that has been aggressively applied to freeze assets and essentially to criminalize people or organizations in the United States. And the key to this category is pretty simple. There is a statutory category of people who can be sanctioned, but that statutory category only includes people who have actually posed a threat to national security, groups who are actually violent, states or their officials who actually act against the United States. What the specially designated global terrorist regime created by President George W. Bush did was to supplement that, was to add to the government's powers by saying, we can designate not just a group that's violent, but any group or person that is associated to it. Right. So what the regime of the SDGT does is allow the government to say, well, this group, which is here in the United States, has some kind of association with a foreign terrorist group, and that's enough to allow us to freeze its assets, to shut down its operations, and to criminalize many forms of speech or association by other U.S. citizens in support of that organization.
You also point out, though, that this does have a very broad reach, as you're talking about, and it actually has been used, though I'm really focused on. I mean, this thing is just, it blows your mind when you look at this. But, this whole thing has been used to go after Iranian social service groups as well, and it was backed up by the U.S. Court of Appeals in doing all that. Let's talk about that court ruling that upholds this, like, really incredibly dangerous and blatant repression of people because of their national background.
Well, there's a court ruling that targets what actually is a fairly unusual, a fairly heterodox Iranian group called the MEK and various entities affiliated it from early in the last decade. And this judicial decision is, I think, important, not necessarily because it designates it allowed the designation of the MEK to proceed. The MEK is a group for which there is some evidence of violence or of involvement with violence itself, not just association with something else that commits violence. What's really significant about this Court of Appeals decision is that it says, look, we are not going to look closely at the evidence that the government presents of an association. We're going to allow the government a great deal of leeway. And what that does is it means that the government, when it's using this specially designated global terrorism label, has 2 degrees of freedom. It has the degree of freedom that comes with saying, if A is associated with B, we can designate A. And then it has a second degree of freedom in terms of it doesn't need to show that association in any great detail. It doesn't need really good evidence that A and B are working in lockstep, because the only entity that reviews that judgment, the court, has said, we're going to give it a light touch.
Well, tell me this, you know, because when you're talking about this, and I'm thinking about the very broad reach of this, because it's one thing when we're talking about, okay, the stuff that George W. Bush did, but this has been carried over. This wasn't sort of one of those things where the Democrats got in and they said, oh, we're glad we're going to get rid of all this. You know, in fact, this thing has only gotten stronger, and you have it has a very broad reach today, and it's been used to go after Iranian social service groups, and now all that was backed up by the U.S. Court of Appeals. Let's talk about this, about the court ruling in particular that was upholding this whole blatant repression of an entire people because of their national background.
Well, I wouldn't go quite so far about the court ruling because, the court ruling is important because of what it allows in the future. But in the actual case itself, there's good reason to believe that the government was targeting that organization because of its links with an actual organization, an actual foreign entity that is itself violent, right? So I think, not the reason to worry about that case. The reason to worry about the case is what happens downstream when you have an administration that is much more willing to play fast and loose with the facts, right? We saw this with respect to the rhetoric around the travel ban. So you invoke the idea of targeting entire groups or targeting entire nationalities and saying, look, this entire group or nationality is dangerous. That's essentially the argument that was made for listing certain nationalities under the travel ban and prohibiting most of their nationals from entering the country. And the government's own analyses at the time demonstrated that these were overbroad at categories that didn't reflect any actual threat. And I think the key thing that people have to realize is that kind of overbroad, sloppy, and careless use of coercive power, of the formidable authority of the state, right, is seen in the travel ban. And you might think, well, that's not worrisome because that's not U.S. citizens, that people who are outside the country. But the fact is that the specially designated global terrorism regime enables the same kind of sloppy, careless, categorical, perhaps tainted judgments to be applied domestically to whole categories of individuals within the United States.
Mm-hmm. And you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Aziz Huq. And Aziz teaches law at the University of Chicago, and he is the co-author of How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. Well, now tell me this, because I'm still trying to get my head around this. It's this question about the ramifications of all this that you're just talking about. There's basically the First Amendment has been erased in relation to all the people that are being targeted by this, right?
That's right. There was a Supreme Court decision about 10 years ago called Humanitarian Law Project versus Holder. And notice that this was Eric Holder, the Democratic Attorney General, who stood behind this law and defended it in the Supreme Court. The Humanitarian Law Project, or HLP decision, held that when a person was coordinating with or associating with a designated entity, that coordinated activity could be criminally penalized, even if it involved speech or association, because terrorism is essentially different, right? The court said, look, you know, if you're giving money to an entity that is accused of engaging in terrorism, let's say you're giving services, right? You're teaching people, as was happening in the case at hand. Let's say you're teaching people about international law, right? What the court said is, look, because you're giving them something, you're giving them knowledge about the international law, that's freeing up some resource that they have, some money that they have, to commit an act of violence. So any kind of contribution, the court reasoned, to an organization of this ilk is fungible. And because it's fungible, because the international law training you're given enables, the court said, the organization to commit acts of violence, your First Amendment protected activity can be criminalized, right? So the court used this peculiar logic of fungibility, peculiar logic of if I give A, the entity can give away B or has more of B, to justify what in other circumstances would never have been an acceptable constraint upon speech that's ordinarily protected by the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Now, here comes the thing that's always going to be out there in these days, the danger of Trump in relation to all of this, and especially against Iranian legal and anti-war groups that have formed.
Yeah, so I think that what's distinctive about the Trump administration, and this is not something that only I have said, but many people who are within the administration or were within the administration have said this, is that previous administrations, including the George W. Bush administration, had a regular, organized process whereby decisions about national security were made and where there was a serious effort to verify and to check intelligence and to make careful judgments about whether a particular action was legal and warranted. And we now have seen a range of incidents during the Trump presidency, not least the recent Soleimani bombing, in which that careful process that accounted for the evidence and that was took care to attend to the law has been jettisoned. And we have essentially shooting literally and metaphorically from the hip without any real consideration of strategic or collateral harms and with an obvious electoral motive in mind. And that's not a good combination of factors to bring to bear when we're talking about people's lives, American citizens' lives, liberties, and constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm. Now, you point out, too, that given what the Supreme Court has said already, the repercussions of a specially designated global terrorist would have a very broad impact across society. I think that's important for people to understand. So can we dig into that a little?
Well, it would mean that these, you know, organizations, and there's been rumblings in certain parts of the right-center media accusing, generally without any evidence, major Iranian-American civil society organizations of somehow being the cat's paw of Tehran, right? There's a risk that sort of accusation, made without any evidence, percolates up into the White House, you know, becomes policy in a fit of pique, and then as a consequence of that, you suddenly have major players in, let's say, the Los Angeles Iranian-American community, major institutions that are providing social services, that are engaging in lawful advocacy before local, state, or federal actors on behalf of their communities, just like many other community groups, just like many other activists and people engaged in their local democracies all across the United States. Those people suddenly find themselves effectively frozen out from their organization. They find the resources of their organization placed out of reach by the federal government, and they find that any effort to elicit aid, potentially even legal aid, for their organization risks criminalizing the person giving the aid, right? That's a very, very dark shadow to fall on a discrete ethnic community of American citizens here in the homeland.
Yeah, it's extremely important, too. I was just thinking about, when you think about then what happened when they had Guantanamo opened up, or not opened up, but they were shipping people in there, you know, by who knows how many people, and a number of people still are in there now to this day. And I want to talk about that a little bit in relation to these legal powers and other, maybe not so legal, but are being able to be used by Trump, the Trump regime, and by the U.S. in general. All the stuff about the authorization of military force, all of these things that actually stand up now. And people, it's something that's been really hidden from people in a very, very intense way. And it's something that can actually change the character of things pretty quickly.
Absolutely. So during the George W. Bush administration, Congress passed two things called authorizations for the use of military force, or AUMFs. And these were essentially legal foundations for the overseas actions in Afghanistan and Iraq. Invoking those congressional measures, which are called AUMFs, the Bush administration seized in the United States, in one case in Illinois, and in the second case in New York State, two individuals, one of whom was a U.S. citizen, one of whom was a visa holder who was attending a university in the United States, seized these two individuals and designated them as enemy combatants, right? Part of the enemy that was targeted in the under the AUMF. And both of these two men were detained for several years without any kind of process or hearing to determine whether they were rightly held. Ultimately, both of them were transferred back to the criminal justice system just before the Supreme Court reviewed their cases. So in both cases, the government managed to avoid a ruling from the Supreme Court that said, using this overseas authorization for the use of military force in the homeland to detain people is unlawful. The net consequence of that is that the lower court rulings that authorized these detentions, and both of the rulings were from the same Court of Appeals, the Fourth Circuit, which at the time was a fairly conservative court. Both of these rulings stand. And so the current law would seem to allow the government to detain people without a criminal trial in the United States merely by saying, well, you're somebody who counts as an enemy of the United States.
All right, Aziz Huq, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, mate. Take care.
Yeah, take care now.
That was Aziz Huq, the Frank and Bernice J. Greenberg Professor of Law at the University of Chicago and author of How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Ghetto Priest with Earthquake in the Heart of Rome.
All right. As things develop in amazing ways, the possibility of Trump being removed from office has never been higher, nor has the danger of the fascist Trump-Pence regime barreling ahead unchecked. The outcome actually depends on what people do. We are at a crossroads, and what we determine to do can determine the future. Here, and actually without hesitation saying it could also determine the future of the planet, really. So given what the stakes are, I was really looking forward to talking with Carl Dix. Now, people have heard Carl on the show a number of times, but just to say it again. Now, Carl, why don't you tell people who you're representing, what your role is there?
Well, my role here is mobilizing people to take to the streets to seize on the opening presented by the fact that the fascist in chief is on trial, and the question of his removal is being put out there, even though his minions in the Senate are trying to run a phony trial, no witnesses, no evidence, quick exoneration. This question is on the table, and I'm here throwing in with the Out Now movement to try to seize the opening and force this open. And as far as what I'm representing for the revolution. That's how I roll. I'm a follower of Bob Avakian and advocate for his new communism. But as a revolutionary communist, I understand that right now it is urgent that everybody throw in whatever perspective they come from to drive this regime out. Because whatever progressive future you're hoping for and acting towards, chances of achieving that, whether that's revolution, whether that's if you feel that America could be made to live up to its promise and that would be a good thing, whatever it is, chances for achieving that go go way down if this fascist regime is able to consolidate its hold on power. Trump is able to remain in office. And look, if he gets exonerated in this trial, he's going to feel vindicated. He's going to move ahead with the juggernaut that has been bearing down on humanity of the fascist regime consolidating power here in this country in the one remaining superpower. So that's something that we have to mobilize everybody we can to seize on, and this is a key moment in doing that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's. I was thinking about that as you were talking, and this whole question of the consolidation of fascism ratcheted up. I mean, there's really, you know, there's been a lot of times that people have been talking about, you know, Trump is a fascist. This is a, you know, there's fascist leanings going on. There's fascist things happening. But in terms of this actually being a ratcheting up of the consolidation of fascism, it's very significant and very dangerous times right now and demanding a certain response from people in the face of this. Let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, because people have to really confront what's at stake here. And just the past 8 days is really critical in that, because you look at more than 20,000 armed fascist stormtroopers, white supremacy at its core. I mean, and other people claiming they weren't white supremacists who were there, but they were quite comfortable swimming in the sewer with white supremacy. That's what that thing in Richmond was. And we should talk about that some. But then that was Monday last week. Friday last week, more than 100,000 folks gathering for the phony March for Life, really the March for Women's Enslavement, seeing Roe versus Wade in their crosshair and feeling like now is our chance to take it down, calling for an end to access to birth control for women, and seeing the consolidation of this fascist regime as the key to doing that. This is what we're up against. This is the future that they want to enforce. Women without the right to abortion, without access to birth control, and being pushed into the position of being incubators and under the thumb of men and under the thumb of a particular man in particular. White supremacists. Like, we went down to Richmond. The city's 50% black. When we rolled into Richmond, you didn't see very many black people on the street. What you saw, people in camouflage carrying their rifles around all over town, rallying Trump 2020, we will not comply, meaning you can pass whatever laws you want, but we got our guns and we're not going to go along with it. This is the future that these people are determined to enforce, and a big part of it is smashing through the norms of how this society has run. And look, as a revolutionary communist, I'm not enamored of the norms of this society, because the norms of this society have shown no problem allowing police terror to go unchecked against black and brown people, no problem having attacks on immigrants, attacks on women's rights, devastation of the climate, the threat of war. All of that predates Trump, but it's all being ratcheted up, taken to a whole different level. And if we don't stop this, it goes to the point, it's like we really are in the situation that the German people were in Hitler's earlier days, when people there were saying, this can't happen here. Germany is a cultured country. Its democracy is quite strong. What you guys are afraid of, the people who were sounding the alarm around Hitler and fascism, can't happen here. Well, we saw what happened there because people did not act soon enough. We don't want to see that repeated, and that's what we're up against now. Because if Trump comes on the other side of this with an exoneration, no matter how phony the trial is, no matter how much they kept the evidence and witnesses out, you know he's going to feel vindicated, kind of like he came out of the Mueller report and then put the squeeze on Ukraine to help him rig the 2020 election. He's going to feel that way and act that way, and there's going to be a lot of barreling ahead on all fronts. So people whose hearts ached when they saw the children torn from their parents' arms down at the border, when they saw immigrants in concentration camps, people who couldn't believe it when they saw, like, mass murders of Latinos, people storming into synagogues and murdering people, people who were, like, really jolted by that, by Muslim bans, there's going to be that in spades if we don't act now. And that's why Refuse Fascism and the Out Now movement have called for people to come to D.C. and flood the Capitol Wednesday, January 29th. We're going to be out in front of the Capitol at 11 a.m. Again at 5. At 5, we're going to rally and then march through D.C. And then we're coming back on Thursday to do it again, because we have to get in the streets and stay in the streets and send a message that the fascist side of this equation isn't the only thing that's mobilizing. It's not the only side that has some enthusiasm and determination for its cause. Mm-hmm. But so far, our side has not shown enough passion, enough determination, and they haven't been in the streets in the way that they need to.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, just real quick on some of that, it's like, as you were talking and as I was reading it over the last week or so, you know, this whole situation, I mean, when you look at like what you were involved in terms of going down to this event in Richmond and basically standing up in the face of these Nazis and very courageously and not minus sort of you, who knows what these people are going to do. After all, this is the same kind of area that even long ago, you know, went out after radical people who were standing up and demonstrating and stuff. These are the people that actually stood up and did shoot and kill people for daring to stand up against what they were advocating, what these Nazis were advocating. And this was like, you know, you're talking about way back in the, you know, like what, 20, 30 years ago. But at the same time, you have this thing now where, and it's very, I was thinking about this as I was just reading and reading what you were saying, listening to some of the stuff that you were saying. And it's sort of, there's a problem here when you look at this. For a while, I think people, and even when people first looked at, like, when you did what you folks did very courageously in relation to the Richmond, Virginia event and walking into the middle of this whole crowd of like fanatical, eat your blood kind of Nazis, there's that. But then there's also the whole, all the, and you started to speak to some of this, but I'd like to explore a little bit more, because I don't think people understand the growing depth that these Nazis have in the country. You know, the fact that this is stuff that's being brought together and consolidated in a way that is very systematic, even though people may think, well, you know, that was the thing that happened down in Richmond, Virginia. But there was also stuff that happened in many other places of the country. And I remember reading something just recently, and it may have been, I can't remember where I read it, but it was, they were talking about, well, actually, there were quite a few things that were happening over that same period of time as you're talking about in Richmond. There's a massive consolidation of fascist forces eager to come everything from, you know, the Christian Nazis to just the good old yahoos that have their guns and their, you know, whatever, and their desire to just get rid of all the people they don't like or the people that they think are a danger to their way of life. Let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, and see, we have to add to this the way in which this has been normalized, because one big outcome of what happened in Richmond with these 20,000 armed, mostly armed people swimming in the sewer of white supremacy is that the news stories, including in the media that is not pro-Trump, not promoting the fascist regime, was that peaceful gun rights rally. And that was a lie. You know, one is they're suppressing the reality that this was a gathering of white supremacists. And two, it wasn't really peaceful, because to me, it ain't peaceful when you come and you deliver a message of intimidation, both to that particular city, but also to people all across the country. That's not peace. That's like, get on your knees, submit to our dictates. But also, this thing was not a gun rights rally. It was white supremacy. You know, we were strolling in, and the people who were supposed to oppose this kind of stuff were nowhere in evidence. Democratic Party leaders, people who were involved in pushing gun control, told the people they could influence, don't go, don't confront this, don't counter-protest, it'll make things worse. Well, one elected official, I think he's a Democratic Socialist, announced that he was going into hiding on that day. Others arranged events that were way far away from there or didn't happen until those things were over. You know, the fascist gathering was over, to kind of divert people away from it. And literally, the National Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour and about a dozen people that we took down there was the only counter-protest, the only one. And we did this. And look, it did take courage to do it, because we knew that the people who were there, a lot of them had been in Charlottesville. And we remembered how they had attacked people there, including they had attacked some of us there, you know, in unprovoked attacks. They murdered Heather Heyer. When we were walking in, we overheard people talking about how it was justified to have killed Heather Heyer, and more of those protesters should have been killed. You know, this was an ugly scene that we were going into. But the reason we went into it and what enabled us to do it is our courage had a scientific foundation. We knew what this thing represented. We knew it represented a leap in the consolidation of fascism, bringing out this armed, unofficial wing, you know, because this isn't the police and the army. This is the unofficial armed wing of this fascist movement, bringing them out, showing their cohesion, delivering a message of intimidation. And we knew that it would be very bad for humanity if this was allowed to go down without opposition. And one of our comrades even said, when we were talking about it, he started out saying, "This is scary," and expressing his fear. But then he said, "Hey, we're doing this for the 7 billion people on this planet." And that's what gives me the strength to go in there and do it. And we went in and unfurled our banners, delivered our message, chanted, you know, and our banners were "Trump, Pence out now," "No to white supremacy," "A better world is possible," and "Revolution, nothing less." And we talked about the leadership we had for this revolution in Bob Avakian, and stepped off from his quote about there being a direct line from the Confederacy to today's fascists. And we did this not once, but twice. Once inside the safe zone, where they had not allowed people to take their guns in. They called it the safe zone. And then we decided to do it again outside the safe zone, where the people were walking around with all their guns. And we did it in the face of howling mobs, but we knew that had to be taken on. And a question that we want to raise, and we've been trying to raise with people, is where were you? Because we know that the majority of people in this country aren't down with that naked white supremacy, aren't down with the enslavement of women, aren't down with these attacks on immigrants and Muslims, you know, aren't down with the devastation of the environment of the very planet that we live on. But they are not expressing that opposition out in the streets. They're not acting on that. They're leaving it to somebody else to take care of this problem. And a fascist regime trying to consolidate its hold on power is not something that can be dealt with by somebody else. It's not something that you can say, well, the Democrats will take care of that, or the elections will take care of it. Because even as the Democrats are having a primary season to choose a candidate to go up against Trump, the fascists are working to rig the election. They're working to rig it through things like what Trump did in the Ukraine by squeezing the guy to do a hit job on Biden. But they're also working to rig it by scrubbing the voting rolls like they're doing in Wisconsin, right out in the open through the legislatures and the courts, or like they've done in Georgia. 300,000 people wiped from the voting rolls in Wisconsin. More than 1 million in Georgia. All this is going down right now, and too many people are not acting, including people who know it's going down. I've had people tell me, I've been out to Howard University's campus, I was out to Georgetown's campus today, and people are telling me they're with me, but they don't think we can do anything about the Republicans, you know, running a sham trial and exonerating Trump in the impeachment, but they're going to get him at the ballot box. And they know that they're trying to rig the ballot box, but they haven't brought that together and drawn from that the understanding that we need to act now and seize on it. And this is something that we're really trying to hammer in right now. And it's a part of why we're putting the effort we are into calling people out in the Capitol on Wednesday and then again on Thursday, because we have to begin to show a growing movement of opposition that is passionate, that is determined. And we're doing that not to show Trump, Pence, and their regime, or the Republicans in Congress mainly. We're doing that to show other people who hate this stuff, would like to see it stopped, but don't see an avenue to do that. We want to show them that there is a force, that this force is gaining traction, and on that basis attract them into it and get them to see that there is a chance to go at this. And we also want to raise to them what's at stake, because in the weeks and months after, if Trump is exonerated in a sham trial and there isn't a real show of opposition, they're not going to sit pat and wait for an election.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask
those
you this.
Who oppose Trump might do that, but Trump and company are not. They're going to keep barreling ahead, and a lot of damage can be done to humanity. Yeah, in just the year between now and the inauguration of the next president.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix. Now, Carl is a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and an advocate for Bob Avakian's New Communism and a co-initiator of Refuse Fascism. Right. Now, let me ask you this. There's some of the stuff that's actually, something's running through everything that you're saying. I think it's important for people to understand this and also to understand what is the... you know, the ruling class doing? What is the ruling structure doing in the face of this? You know, there's this whole question that you've been speaking to about what fascism is and what it'll take to defeat it. But it's also, while much of the fascist crimes of the Trump regime were left out of the Democrats' impeachment hearings. I mean, if you listen to that, what the Democrats were saying and doing throughout all this, they were not mentioning that, yo, we got a Nazi here and we got to stop him. You know, they're rolling in down the streets and they're setting up something that is not, should never be accepted by anyone, that this is actually some kind of legitimate political move. But there's actually, it's also very clear, the big point was out there when people were talking about, you know, we're going up against Trump, not going up against the Nazis, we're going up against Trump. That's the way it came out a lot of times. But it's also very clear that Trump wasn't going to walk quietly into the night. You know, it's not like he's not going to turn around and say, oh, well, forget it. His process is a clarion call to Nazis to step things up. And this puts us, people who do understand a little bit more or understand the danger that society is in, we're at a pretty crucial crossroads right now, a strategic moment, you know, and that's something that cannot be wasted or thrown away. It's very dangerous not to pay attention to that.
Yeah, that's very important. I want to change the phrasing on that a little bit because it's not just those of us who understand are at this crucial turning point. All of us who don't want to see fascism enforced in this country are at this crucial turning point. And the problem is most of the people who don't want to see that happen don't realize that this is a turning point. They don't get that. And we have to work to bring that to them and show them how we can indeed act on it. You know, because we go to Howard University and overwhelmingly people are like, yeah, Trump out of there as soon as possible. I'm with that. But they don't see taking the next step of stepping into helping to make that happen. And when you get into that, it's like, well, you can't. The fix is in. The deal is done. The Republicans are going to exonerate him. That shouldn't happen, but that's the way it's going to go down. And that is actually, again, something that part of the responsibility for that view being so widespread does lay with the side of the ruling class that is actually fighting against Trump. We actually have to say, while they were reluctant to go to impeachment, Pelosi was like, we don't want to do this. They have actually gone to it. They have made, Adam Schiff made some very significant arguments about why Trump should be impeached. They have kept it on narrow terms. They've gone after the attempt to sabotage the election and the abuse of the power of his office, which actually does reflect some reality because Trump's people have been trying to sabotage the elections. They have abused the power of their office. They're using that to keep witnesses. They kept witnesses out of the articles of impeachment discussion in the House of Representatives. Now they have the Senate, where Republicans have the majority, trying to keep witnesses and evidence out of the Senate trial, even as more evidence bubbles up to the surface every day. You know, Lev Parnas, mostly to try to save his own behind, is putting the deal out there. John Bolton, for his own reasons, because Bolton is not a nice guy who has the interest of humanity at heart, but he is bringing out, hey, this was the equivalent of a drug deal, and all of them were caught up in it. He's bringing all that out, but they're trying to keep that out of the trial. And look, this thing of narrowing it down to those terms, partly it is that the Democrats and their side of the ruling structure really see this because they understand that they are in the crosshairs of this. I mean, the stuff about Adam Schiff has not yet paid the price for what he's done to this country in Trump's tweet. This is really targeting the leaders of the Democratic Party. And again, we can go to the history of fascism moving into power. When Hitler took power, he actually targeted what was called the Weimar Republic, the democratic government that was in power before Hitler took over. And he had to crush that in order to consolidate and enforce fascism. Well, that's what's happening now. But we have to bring the whole agenda out in this, because it's that whole fascist agenda that brings to bear the way in which this has already come down on the people, whether that's the attacks on immigrants, whether that's the attempts to take away the rights of women, LGBTQ people, whether that's the unleashing of the white supremacy, the devastation of the environment, and the intensification of that. We have to bring that whole agenda out. That's why we're calling on people to bring signs out to the Capitol to say why they think the Trump-Pence regime needs to go. And through that, to reach out to many other people, because there's a lot of awareness of the horrors that Trump, Pence, and the whole regime represent. Even among people who don't see any way to do anything about it except to wait for the elections and pull the lever for the donkey, you know, the Democratic donkey.
Let me ask you,
we have to bring out to them the need to act and also the possibility to accomplish something if we do act.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, man, because it's, and I think it's directly off of this, you know, we're at a crucial crossroads. It's evident from what you're saying, from anybody who pays attention to what's actually going on in society, including, you know, and there's all kinds of people that actually have closed their eyes and don't want to face up to this. But it's a strategic moment. And the impeachment of Trump is very important in terms of this, as you've been saying. It's imperative that the consolidation of fascism be stopped. Now, what will it mean if it's not stopped now?
Okay, that's very bad for the people. It's bad for humanity. It's not just bad for people in this country. It's bad for people around the world, because you do have a regime that has committed great crimes against humanity. And we could just go through the list, or we could stay on some of the recent ones, you know, like assassinating a leading figure in the Iranian government while he was in Iraq, and then trying to assassinate another leading figure in the Iranian government while he was in Yemen. That's a war crime. That's just straight up a war crime and a declaration of anybody who opposes us anywhere in the world, we can take them out. And then we will justify it by talking about crimes that they have committed, when the U.S. is actually the real bloody-jawed beast, the country and the empire that is inflicting great damage on humanity all around the world. And if he and his regime survive this impeachment, they are going to be feel like they can go on a roll. And they've already been barreling ahead, but it's going to be like, okay, I'm vindicated now. I can go ahead with my attempts to rig and sabotage the election. I can go ahead with my assassination of people around the world who I feel oppose the interest of the American empire and the keeping it together and expanding it based on the program that I see fit. I can go ahead, and they're actually already going ahead with their attacks on immigrants. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision just passed this week, the means testing for immigrants that will allow them to say that certain immigrants should not be allowed to come into the country, and whether that's as refugees or as immigrants, because they don't have enough wealth and they may become burdens on society, even though the actual reality is that immigration adds quite a bit to the country, not just in terms of the diversity and the culture, but also to the country's economy. Because there are sectors of the economy that really rest on immigrant labor. But they want to have the ability to bar certain people. And you know how that's going to come out. That's going to come out that brown immigrants from Central and South America, immigrants from Africa and Asia, they're going to be the ones who are going to run into that. So what it is at this point, the question of building the kind of opposition, bringing significant numbers of people into the streets and getting them to stay in the streets and sustain nonviolent protest that can have a shot at breaking things open in this trial, pushing over the top the calls for there to be witnesses and evidence in the trial, which could then take the trial to an end that is not yet written, you know, and that the deal may not actually be able to go through, and Trump could be removed. And if that happens, you also have the fact that many of the people in his regime, the vice president, the secretary of state, the attorney general, his chief of staff, were all involved in the stuff, even though they've narrowed it down, the stuff that he's on trial for, all of them were involved in this. So from one end, that could happen. But then from another end, if we fail to mobilize the kind of opposition that's needed, and if he goes through and is exonerated, then you're really talking about fascism on a roll, barreling ahead, picking up its pace, both in terms of the agenda that gets enforced and hammered into place, and in terms of the shock troops being mobilized and unleashed to fight for this throughout society. Now, even if we do mobilize significant opposition and it grows and sustains itself, we could end up losing in this impeachment battle. But we would be in much better position if, even if we lost, we came out of it with a much larger section of the people who opposed the Trump-Pence regime and the fascist agenda that it's ramming down our throats, who have been energized, who have been mobilized, and who have been organized. And that would put us in a much better position to fight forward on it, because you are talking about a guy who has already told you that, you know, because he was asked in 2016, was he going to accept the results of the election? And he said, well, if I win, I'll accept it. But if I lose, I'm going to think it's rigged and I don't accept the results of a rigged election. So what will he say in 2020 when the election comes down? Mm-hmm. Whether it goes down the same way and he loses the popular vote but wins the Electoral College, or what if he even loses through the Electoral College? Is he going to go quietly into the night and say, well, I did my best, but I lost? Or is he going to say, there must have been undocumented immigrants voting. There must have been people stuffing the ballot box. This is rigged. I didn't really lose. I'm not leaving the White House. And who or what will make him leave the White House? Because I'm old enough to remember back when Nixon resigned. I hated Nixon. I hated everything he stood for and represented. But Nixon actually resigned when he could see the writing on the wall and that the crimes that he had been involved in were being exposed to the world. Trump is not going to do that. He does not give a damn if the world sees the crimes that he's carried out. He is going to persevere and attempt to continue to carry them out. And there will be a question of who or what would force him to leave. So even just from the perspective of people who are looking at electoral solutions, it's likely, very likely going to call for more than that, much more than that, to actually stop this regime. And in relation to that, we have to look at the fact that the Democrats, even though they are now trying to impeach Trump, made good arguments on that. One thing that they have not done is they have not called on the people who would be their base to come into the streets. The farthest they've gone is, I think at one point Chuck Schumer said that people should flood the Senate switchboard with phone calls. Phone calls to the Senate switchboard are not enough to stop this fascist regime from consolidating its power. It's going to take people in the streets coming from all kinds of different perspectives, everybody. Democrats who want to see a continuation of what things were like before Trump, reformed Republicans, Green Party people, but also people who see that, like, the fascism of the Trump-Pence regime was actually spawned by this capitalist imperialist system, and see the need to get beyond that system. Mm-hmm. And are listening when we say revolution, nothing less, is the real solution to the problems of this capitalist imperialist system. We're all going to need to be out there as part of stopping this regime from consolidating its power and driving it out. And we in the Movement for an Actual Revolution are going to be doing that from the perspective of getting ready and in position to go forward from that, to do what's needed to stop these horrors once and for all. And that's making an actual revolution, something that we do have the leadership for in Bob Avakian. We have the strategy and science in his new communism that he's forged for that. And we have a vision of the kind of society that could be brought into being through revolution and the Constitution for a future socialist republic in North America.
All right, Carl. Unfortunately, we just got to wrap it up right about now. But people really do have to pay attention to what you've just said, including, I mean, I kept thinking about this as you're talking. We're facing a new situation, a lot of uncertainty and a lot of necessity. But what it is necessary and it is possible. And that's what people have to keep in mind. So, Carl, tell me just
I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Two websites.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get. Go ahead.
Before I go, two websites. Go to the website refusefascism.org. It's got the analysis of the situation, number of different voices speaking to that, coming from different perspectives, but coming together around driving out the Trump-Pence regime, and it's got the plans for the activities right now and going forward in acting to try to drive this regime out. Also go to the website revcom.us.
So, Carl, can you give people some information right before we leave about, again, what is going on and when?
Look, we're calling on people to flood D.C. Wednesday, January 29th at 11 a.m. Out Now is holding a rally right by the U.S. Capitol building. First Street Northeast and Constitution Avenue at 11 a.m. we're going to rally. And then again at 5 p.m., again near the Capitol at Delaware Avenue Northeast and Northeast Drive, we're going to have a rally. And then we're going to march from the Capitol into D.C. and through D.C., taking the message, Trump, Pence, out now. And this is a moment to seize to try to actually make that real and drive this regime out. And then we're going to come back on Thursday and be at the Capitol again at 11 a.m., right by the Senate building. And then 5 p.m., we're going to rally at Delaware Avenue Northeast and Northeast Drive and march through D.C. Here's the ways to get in touch. Go on social media and look for @RefuseFascism. If you want to go old school and dial us up, call 917-407-1286.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today, and I look forward to talking to you again soon, man.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
I want to thank all of my guests today, Aziz Huck and Carl Dix. I also want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and the person without whom this show would not be as good as it is, my assistant producer, Henry Carson.
I want to hear your thoughts, see it all. Like a heated wave through the walls. You want to go out tonight. You want to know what